and said you filled out the papers, and the guy I know said no, you didn't fill out no papers up to his place. He went and checked.
Does my mother know that?
She asked weakly, and his mournful nod betrayed the magnitude of her mother's wrath.
Can I borrow $3, Uncle Rainey?
He stirred a finger through the paint discs. She said not to give you any money. He cleared his throat. And she said to tell you if you went to the lake, she'd come and get you and drag you home.
He reached out, and she cringed with the touch of his damp hand.
Alice, don't look at me like that. Don't be mad at me. I can't help you run away. I can't do that.
She was crying now. I'm not running away, Uncle Rainey. I just want to go to the lake. I'm just so sick of it here. I'm just so sick of everything.
He threw his arms around her and hugged her tight and made a sound as if he were crying too. But you can't just run away, he said. Things are always running away from me.
His head twisted to one side, and she felt him jerk as if with an enormous jolt.
Oh, oh, he moaned. And I ran away, too.
The A-plus X manager was Mr. Coughlin. His bloodshot eyes narrowed on her chest.
Size 6?
He asked, then smiled smugly when she nodded.
Here's one,
he said, handing her the uniform. Black pants, pink and black checked blouse, black vest, and peaked black cardboard cap.
Nights,
he said, sitting down behind a ketchup-splattered table that was his desk.
4 to 12.
He widened his eyes and lowered his voice.
The lunatic shift.
On the table was a bronze plaque with raised letters that said, Screw me and you're hired. Cheat me and you're fired. The cluttered back room buzzed with flies. Outside in the lot, a car was honking its horn. The sign over Coughlin's head said, You don't have to be crazy to work here, but it helps. Stacked in the corners were cartons of cellophaned hamburg rolls. The tiny office reeked of grease and pickles.
Got a boyfriend?
No, she said.
Good, because I won't stand for the studs hanging out all night tying up the stations. Now, first off, take this menu home and study it. Spills and mistakes come out of your pay, understand?
She nodded.
And the second thing is, don't try stealing food out to your buddies. It won't work. We got a system here of numbered checks. Got that?
She nodded.
And third, we got the A-plus-X motto, good food with a smile.
He drew in his chin and looked around.
I got my own motto, get 'em in and get 'em out fast. Capiche?
She nodded again. He screwed up his mouth disgustedly.
Jesus Christ, you some kind of mute?
He held out his hands.
What? You shy? You scared? What is it?
I was concentrating on what you were saying, she said stiffly. He looked at her.
Oh, I get it.
He lit a cigarette and squinted through the smoke.
I should have known. You're the type that's too good to work here, right? You think this place sucks.
He laughed.
And you think I suck, too.
She had opened the door to go outside. He was a pig, and she hated him.
Well, you're right. I do,
he howled.
But you need a job, doll. Now, don't you?
As she came to the front of the building, a buzzer sounded over and over again. Through the service window peered the blocky head of the cook, Anthology Carper, his eyes pink as sores, his blue-tinted flesh seeming to glow.
92's up,
he screeched into the microphone.
75's up.
His eyes caught hers, and he stuck out his tongue and wiggled it at her.
69's up,
he giggled, wiggling his tongue again. With his trousers pressed and his shoes gleaming, Omar Duval strode briskly down the street under a high blue sky, and he felt so good. He felt better than good. He felt sure. He felt nimble. The old spring was back in his step. He bounced up and down on the curbstone now while he waited for the light to change, then laughed softly as he passed in front of the idling cars. Omar Duval was stepping out. Yes, sir, he was on his way. No matter how low a man fell, he could always get back on his feet as long as he had faith, faith in himself and faith in life's unlimited opportunities. He turned the corner, and as he neared Marie's shabby little house, he smiled, relieved to see her car waiting for him in the driveway, just as she had promised. He had an appointment this afternoon in Bennington with the Northeast distributor of Roy Gold Enterprises. He took the matchbook cover from his pocket and read it again. Presto soap. Do you want to be safe all your life but stuck in the same old rut? Or are you willing to take that first step onto the ladder of success?
Where I belong,
he whispered as he stepped into the dim back hall cluttered with winter jackets, muddy boots, mops, and brooms and snow shovels.
Right on the very top rung,
he sighed, impulsively gathering up the shovels and jackets and boots which he deposited in the garage. On his way back, he spotted Marie's laundry basket protruding from the lilac bush. Typical, he thought. That was so much of her trouble. Carelessness, a lack of organizational skills. It was sad the way she let life overtake her, leaving in its wake this yard, the chaotic house, her frantic children. The poor woman had no faith in herself. He grabbed the wicker handle, then jumped back from the dark, wet growl of Klubok's dog crouched in the bushes. His hand shot into his pocket, but of course the knife was gone, for that had been another time, another life. Only this was real, this moment, this pang in his breast. Sweat stung his eyes.
Good morning,
chirped a voice from the trees. Wiping his brow, he looked around, then saw Jessie Klubok's round buttocks plumped on the second-floor sill, where she sat washing windows.
And a good morning to you, ma'am,
he called, and she waved her rag.
Doesn't this look like fun?
She called back, gesturing so excitedly now with both hands that he was afraid she would fall.
Oh, it certainly does,
he said, shading his eyes, dizzied by her smallness against the sun-struck glass.
Then grab a rag and join me, she called.
I would, except that I am deathly afraid of heights, he hollered up.
I don't believe that. A great big thing like you.
She laughed and began to scrub the window pane with such exuberance that for a moment he couldn't move. He gazed up with a throb of the old longing, not so much for flesh or even for his own comfort and solace as for a woman's blind, unquestioning trust, a woman in need, a woman who would believe. The back hall door swung open.
Mr. Duval,
Benji called, and Omar hurried inside with the boy at his heels.
I thought you were gone, Benji said nervously. I saw you come in the hall and then you left. I didn't know what you were doing.
Just trying to help your dear mother.
He put his hand on the boy's shoulder and felt him flinch.
Which you should be doing as well, son, helping your mother in every possible way.
He squeezed the bony shoulder and saw Benji's face steel with resolve.
Can you do that?
He asked, and the boy nodded.
Promise me now, he said. Promise you'll do whatever it takes to make her happy.
I promise.
Benji did not blink. He stared up at Duval, who for a moment could not move or reply.
Good enough,
he finally said in a hoarse whisper, then looked away, heart racing, cheeks flushed, not with the heat of guileful shame, but with awe at this mastery that sometimes left him weak with the burden of his own powers.
Here's the keys, Benji was saying, and she made you a lunch, too.
The boy handed him a limp paper bag that smelled of tuna fish. She had mentioned gas money. Hoping she had remembered, Omar looked inside. There were 3 $1 bills and a note that said, Call me as soon as you hear anything. Good luck, Marie. Noticing a smudge above her name, he held the paper to the window and saw where she had erased love. He said goodbye to Benji and was starting the car when he realized the boy was still in the doorway, watching with a troubled expression. He rolled down the window.
What is it?
He called. Benji's mouth opened and closed, and then he shrugged.
Nothing, he said through a weak smile.
He was backing down the driveway when he saw a head bob alongside his window. He hit the brake.
Damn it, boy, what are you doing?
I was just wondering,
the boy called over the engine's roar. Wincing, he blurted.
Are you coming back?
Of course I'm coming back. Of course I am,
Omar said. Not only amused and flattered by the boy's apprehension, but drawn to it, energized by that mistrust with its inexpressible longing, by the loneliness, the terrible loneliness of lights burning through the night and telephones seized at the first ping, by that pain seeping sometimes into his own sleep, the pain of all those hearts in time with his own, even though he knew there was little one man could do to set it all right, so very, very little. And so with a sigh, he pulled out of the driveway, then stared down the narrow one-way street. His grip tightened on the wheel, and suddenly he knew exactly what the boy knew, that he was not coming back, not ever. He had a car, money in the pocket of his freshly cleaned and pressed suit, and there on the torn seat beside him, his next meal. He was free as a bird, with nothing to hold him, nothing to get in his way. He could just keep on going. Why not? What was stopping him? The boy's eyes still on him? Marie? Well, if anything, it would teach her a damn good lesson. Yes, sir, a woman alone like that shouldn't ever let a stranger into her home. Lucky for her it had been him and not some thieving, murdering pervert. Oh, it was pathetic. It really was, a woman like that, so wanting, so lonely, so desperate she'd open her door to kindness no matter its guise or form. With his arm on the window well, he cruised down the street, the breeze flapping his sleeve. One of these days, real soon as he could, he'd write her a letter, telling what a fine woman she was. A woman of strength, a woman of character. Yes, sir, first chance he got, first opportunity, he'd write and say, "My dear Marie, my dear, dearest, sweet Marie, I have roamed this vast country far and wide, and I have met many a fine woman, but none as good, as lonely, as stimulating as—" "Oh, fucking Jesus!" he cried. His foot shot to the brake, and the car lurched to a stop before he could turn. Parked ahead on the distant corner was his old, dusty station wagon. He slumped behind the wheel and watched the driver's door open. Luther climbed out, then walked around to the other side of the car. He helped Reverend Peace out, then steadied him on his feet. The old man clung to the open door while Luther tugged a flimsy jacket onto his shoulders and centered the familiar pork pie hat on his head. Luther led him shuffling onto the sidewalk. Luther looked up and seemed now to be pointing toward this very corner where Omar sat, eyes glazed with terror as his hand slipped slowly, so slowly it would take days to pass from the wheel to the stick to shift the car into reverse. The old man shook his head and stomped his feet in the perverse jig that meant he'd been bullied enough by the sullen Luther, and now he'd have his way. He pointed toward the next street, which Omar realized must have been where they last saw Early. Yes, that was the very street down which Early had chased him. But how much did they really know? Had the old man actually seen his grandson follow Omar into the woods? He couldn't have, Omar reasoned, and yet that was exactly where the old man was heading. Through the mirror, Omar stared back at those crow-infested tangled trees that loomed as the limping old man's magnetic destination. They were the only ones who could link him to Early that day, and so he had no choice now but to stop them. They had forced him to this. He hunched over the wheel, playing it through with such brutal clarity that only a moment later the act would seem blurred and unreal, its commission more dream than deed. The stuck gas pedal, a dip, then a bump in the road, the huge engine accelerating out of control, hurtling the car onto the sidewalk, crushing them both. It would stagger out as neighbors ran from their houses.
"Duval,"
the old man might moan. There would be sirens. Only his eyes moved. Yes, there would be sirens, distant sirens. Questions he could not answer. No, better to drive away. His foot eased to the gas pedal, then froze. If he did leave now, he'd be a hunted man, whether they found Early in there or not. They'd be right on his tail. It was a small town. As soon as Marie reported her car gone, they would know. They knew all his tricks. No, sir. He had to stay calm, cool, collected, and he had to keep thinking like them every minute. Just crawl inside the old man's head to know what he knows and go where he goes, because it wasn't spilled blood the old thief was tracking down, but a hard-beating, hard-pumping heart he knew as well as his own. Better to keep the old man pursuing love, a more alluring quarry than death. Love to keep the gears turning, to keep them all moving. The old man had faith enough to search forever for his grandson, so Omar would provide the lure, proof that Early was still alive, but far, far from here. He hurried into the kitchen, and the boy's head shot up, his cheeks smeared with colored ink. He had fallen asleep, drooling on the open comic book.
"Now listen carefully," he said, dragging a chair close. "Remember every word I tell you, because I am in very, very great danger, and I need your help."
Benji stared, as if peering up from a watery dream.
"It's not just me," he whispered,
gripping the boy's arm, demanding, imploring through flesh and bone, his fingertips pulsing a beat of such urgency that for a long time after there would be bruises on the soft white underflesh.
But all of us, we're all counting on you, so listen to every single word I say.
It was Luther who first heard Benji. The old man kept walking, each foot lifting with the heft of stone, then falling onto the sidewalk.
"What you want?"
Luther asked with the same resignation of the old man's plodding journey.
"You want something?"
The whites of his eyes were yellow and hot, and his skin gleamed in the sunshine. The words died on Benji's tongue. Now the old man looked at him. His gold front tooth sparkled. Next to the younger man's, his dark skin seemed dull and as drab as if coated with dust.
"You live around here, boy?"
the old man asked.
"Yes, sir."
His reply seemed more gesture than sound. He had never spoken to a black man before.
"You seen this young man round?"
the old man asked, moving toward Benji with his weighted step. The paler palm of his hand cupped a worn, tissuey photograph. It was the picture of a boy not much older than Benji. He shook his head, then looked up, and nodded. It vaguely resembled the man he had seen in the woods that day with Omar.
"When?"
the old man demanded, hobbling closer. He reeked of sweat and still dark ponds.
"A couple of weeks ago," Benji said,
Omar's carefully chosen words bobbing to the surface now.
"Right down there,"
he pointed toward the distant woods. "I was on my way home from school, and he came out of the woods, and he asked, did I want to buy any magazines? And I said, no, I couldn't, I didn't have any money. And he laughed, and he said, money? You need money? And he pulled out this big, thick thing of money, of dollar bills in this silver thing that had a D engraved on it, and..."
"Duval's clip," the young man cried.
He looked at the old man and yelped,
"That be Duval's clip, and Duval's cash,"
said the old man, so gleefully clapping his hands that he stumbled. Luther steadied him by the back of his shirt. The old man just kept talking.
"What he say then? Early, what he say?"
He said, here, and he gave me a dollar, and he told me not to tell the big white man in the white suit I saw him, because he was on his way down to see his best girl, Lady Dwelly, in Hankam, Mississippi.
"Oh, my Lord,"
gasped the grinning old man. He laid his hands on Benji's shoulders.
"Try telling me now there ain't no divine purpose behind all that we do, Mr. Luther Corbett."
Luther just shook his head, apparently conceding the old man right for once.
"His best girl, who is Lady Dwelly, in Hankam, Mississippi."
The old man closed his eyes and sighed.
"God did this. God sent this child. And now we're going to return the favor, child."
His bloodshot eyes widened.
"That big white man Early told you about, his name is Omar Duval. And you ever see him, you watch out, because he is a bad, bad man. He's what you call a treacherous man. He got knives. He got a switchblade with a snakeskin handle and a blade so sharp it can slice through bone quick as that,"
hissed the old man, with such a sudden zigzagging thrust of his fist that Benji jumped.
"You scaring him. But that's the favor," said the old man, drawing back. "Fear might just save your life one day, child." "What's your name?"
Luther asked, reaching into his pocket. He held out a quarter.
"I gotta go now,"
Benji said. He ran away, relieved, because that must have been just the way it had happened that day in the woods, just as Omar had told him. Early had stolen Omar's money, and now he was on his way to Mississippi, and he suddenly realized that the glint he had seen that day, that glint through the leaves, had not been a blade at all, but the silver money clip they had both been struggling for. At 5 o'clock, Renie LaChance locked the door and pulled the shade over the glass. He opened a can of cat food and another can of sardines and poured more milk into Tom's bowl. Then he reached under the counter for his slim green ledgers. In one he printed $4.50, Mrs. Ottoman's vegetable bins, $2.25, Mrs. Crowley's reflector pans. That was the ledger the IRS could see. He opened the second ledger and turned the pages. In this one he recorded the day's cash sales, $12, fan, $5.95, lint filter. On the next line he wrote, "Slow day at Cushing's, only 65 customers, approximately $195 by my estimation, temperature 83 degrees, sunny, muggy, terrible smell, a stink, makes some people sick in their stomach. Friday night, Helen hit Sam over the head with her statue. Police came. Now with Sam gone, Helen will get meaner and meaner to me, like always. Best news, Alice came in store and picked out the color yellow, just like sunshine. Golden Toasty rep coming to check store next week. I'm nervous. If I get it, I will put a sign up that says Exclusive Golden Toasty Dealer in gold letters, and people will come from all over. He looked at his watch. Only 5:15, the part of the day he least knew what to do with. There was no place for him between 5 and dinner at 6:30. In a way, it was the loneliest part of the day. All the ladies would be busy now in their kitchens, their hands too greasy or full to pick up their phones, so their children would answer, or their husbands. When he had Riddles, this was the time he used to take him for walks. It hurt to remember what Sam had said about Helen burying Riddles, but he couldn't allow himself such a terrible belief. If it was true, he would have to do something. What, he didn't know, but it would be not only final, but probably the worst act he'd ever committed. It might even be murder, he realized, shuddering. Or love, he thought with sudden terror. All at once he rushed into the bathroom, sat down, and dialed his own number.
Hello,
came Helen's crisp voice.
Hello? Hello? Who is this?
And then she hung up. He called her two more times. She answered, then slammed down the phone when she got no response. On the third call, he stared up at his pictures, his gaze swimming in glossy blindness.
What do you want?
Gasped Helen's thin, frightened voice.
Why do you keep calling?
He touched himself and moaned softly, thinking of the soft white skin on her shoulder.
Oh,
she said.
You stop. You just leave me alone.
He leaned back, legs apart, one hand on the phone at his ear, the other hand gently stroking as he moaned, his eyes closed with her scared little voice in his ear, in his heart, deep, deep in his groin. When it was over, he watched himself in the mirror as he washed his sticky hands in the small stained sink, and he saw how his eyes glowed and how his cheeks were flushed, and a great wonder seized him because he had never, ever dared do this with any of the others. He drove home with an ache burning in his chest and the knowledge that he loved his wife very much. As was Helen's custom when he came through the door, she took his plate from the oven and set it on the table. She never ate, but seemed to live on air, he thought, without need of any bodily functions, not sex, not food, not defecation.
Sit down, he said quickly, before she could leave the kitchen.
Why? She asked, eyes steeled for the bad news her life attracted.
Well, I got things to tell you, he said.
From his pocket he withdrew the yellow disc and held it out to her.
For the store, he said,
laying it on the table when she didn't take it. He told her about the Golden Toasty line and the salesman he expected and the gold-lettered sign, and now he was amazed to hear himself telling her about his surplus of fans, confessing how foolish he had felt all this past year with them jam-packing the storeroom. But then he'd sold one last Friday and another today, so this heat might turn out to be a real lifesaver. He loved her fine thin neck and her slim, delicate fingers. People were drooping with the heat. They'd pay any price for cool air. He was a lucky man to have such a fine wife.
Oh, Helen, he cried when she took a step toward him.
Put your plate in the sink, she said, opening the door. I'll be outside weeding. Before the last car had even left her station, Alice yanked off her shiny black hat and apron and stuffed them in her pocket. Most of the girls were already in the back room smoking with Coughlin. She was relieved and flattered not to have been asked to join them. They knew better, she thought, as she waited out at the curb for Norm to pick her up. Her third night here, and it had been the worst one yet. Her co-workers were crude and impatient with her, and the customers thought for the price of a root beer they could treat her like dirt. She had mixed up orders again tonight, dropped a full tray, and then at the height of the supper rush the bathroom door had jammed, trapping her inside.
Stupid bitch! Stupid bitch!
Coughlin had ranted as he jimmied free the door to let her out. It was midnight, and only a few cars had been by. She leaned forward with each headlight, hoping it was Norm. She could feel Anthology Carper's lewd, bulbous eyes on her.
All night long she'd slid her orders through his window, holding her breath with her eyes averted, her stomach weak at such propinquity, such familiarity with a creature so ugly, so foul-mouthed and cruel, that last night when she cut her thumb on a broken glass, he'd laughed to see the blood. Headlights rose in the distance, and now a low-slung gray Chevy pulled into the lot. Stiffening, she tried to cover the side of her face. It was Blue Mooney here for Carper, who was his cousin. He leaned over to comb his hair in the rearview mirror before he got out of the car. Under the floodlights, his full mouth and his eyes seemed to gleam. He glanced back and caught her looking at him. As much as he gave her the creeps, there was also this secret fascination. She would see him strutting downtown with his hoodie friends or at the band concerts in the park, and it would be an effort to look away. From the corner of her eye now, she saw him turn quickly. She bit her lip, praying he didn't recognize her from the lake. For the past two nights she had managed to avoid him. He was behind her now at the greasy order window, speaking in a low voice to his cousin. She heard her name, and now she cringed as his boots clicked toward her.
"You're new here, huh?"
he said, grinning. She nodded, then stared past him at the dark, empty road, hugging herself a little tighter.
"I seen you from somewhere, but I can't place where."
He passed back and forth, studying her from different angles.
"It'll come to me,"
he said, snapping his fingers while he peered down at her.
"One of these days,"
he said, grinning again.
"How about you? You remember me from someplace? I look familiar to you at all?"
"No," and she knew by his dying grin that he had indeed recognized her and was irritated by her snub. Now she was afraid. He wasn't just a hood, but a thief. Last year he and his older brother, who was on parole, had been caught breaking into Mrs. Bonifant's gas station. He'd be in jail now with his brother if it hadn't been for Chief Stoner getting the judge to let him go into the Marines. Lester had said people weren't happy he was back in town, even if it was only temporarily. She wondered if Lester had told his father about Mooney threatening him graduation night. Probably. Behind them rose Coughlin's angry voice, then Carper's shrill retort, and now each man simultaneously telling the other what he could do.
"Fuck yourself! Go fuck yourself!"
like an ugly echo.
"Jerry's a creep, huh?"
Mooney laughed, then hooked his grimy thumbs in his hip pockets and stretched, arching his back.
"I'd put up with that shit for about 2 seconds.
She stepped closer to the curb.
"Hey, need a ride?"
he asked, stepping next to her. He gestured at his car.
"She's got glass packs," he bragged. "Brand new."
"My brother's coming," she said, tensing as he seemed to move even closer. He nodded.
"Hey,"
he said, as if it were a sudden brainstorm.
"Maybe sometime tell him don't come, and I'll give you a ride."
"Well, he has to. My mother wants him to." She stared miserably up the street. Where was Norm?
"Oh, yeah. Well, what are you going to do, huh? Mothers are like that."
He tapped a cigarette from his pack, then offered her one. She shook her head.
"Maybe that's him,"
he said, striking a match with a flick of his thumb.
"Guess so,"
he sighed as Norm slowed down. Her mother's loud, creaky car ground to a stop, and she jumped in.
"See you tomorrow night,"
Mooney called as they roared off. She turned now and saw Norm's bruised cheek and swollen, bleeding lip. Norm and Weeb and Tommy Mullins had been up on Town Line Road chasing Parkers when Billy Hendricks and a carload of his friends blocked Norm's car. Hendricks and Norm had fought in a long, gasping match that had ended only when they were finally dragged apart. "Why did you do that?" she stared at him. "Do you know how embarrassed I feel? Those are all kids in my class." He hunched over the wheel. "What's wrong with you? What are you always trying to prove? God, Norm, it's bad enough with Dad, and now with that Duval around. I mean, I just can't take it. It's so embarrassing." She turned away, trying not to cry. "I can't wait to get out of here. I can't wait. I hate it here so much." The car flew along. "Norm, slow down. You're speeding, Norm," she screamed, then grabbed his arm. He shoved her away so hard that she fell against the door.
"I'll get you out of here," he hollered over the roar of the engine.
"Norm, stop it, please."
"Tell me where you want to go," he bellowed. "Want to go visit Dad?"
He was crying, pushing her away as she came toward him again.
"I know. We'll go get the fucking priest. That's what we'll do."
She looked over his arm at the trembling speedometer. "You're going 85. Please stop. Don't do this, Norm." She covered her face with her hands.
fucking bastards, he growled. Goddamn fucking no good.
A police siren screamed after them, its light flashing.
Norm!
The car rumbled over the soft shoulder, then finally stopped. Lester's father was getting out of the cruiser behind them. She took a deep breath, then leaned forward as his flashlight shone from Norm's face to hers.
I thought it was your car, Alice, he said. What happened?
The light fixed on Norm's face.
Who did that to you, Norm?
Nobody,
Norm mumbled, eyes downcast.
I fell.
Where you been, Norm?
Home,
he said, trying to cover his mouth so the chief wouldn't smell his breath.
That happened at home?
Yep.
Wasn't that big guy, was it? That friend of your mom's?
No.
Norm looked up angrily, and Alice's stomach weakened with the realization that everyone knew about Duval, too.
I said I fell, Norm was saying. I fell off a ladder.
What's going on here? What's this speeding all about?
Stoner asked. From the way he was staring at Norm, Alice was afraid he might arrest him.
The pedal stuck,
Norm said.
I kept trying to pull it up.
Stoner leaned in the window. He looked at her.
Pedal got stuck?
He said softly. She nodded.
It's okay now?
It's okay, she said.
All right. But why don't you drive the rest of the way home, Alice? Just to be on the safe side. Okay, kids?
They both nodded, and she could tell from his hesitation that he wanted to say something about Les. Then, thinking better of it, he patted the window well. He stepped back as Norm got out and walked around the back of the car to the other side. She slid behind the wheel.
Take it easy now,
he called as she pulled onto the road.
Norm,
she said when they were out of Stoner's sight. She thought she'd heard him say something.
What is it?
I'm sorry, he sobbed. I mean it. I really am.
Where am I?
Sam Fermoyle asked, wincing at the stringy sound of his own voice. His head hurt. He touched his bandaged wound where the shaved hair had started to grow back. His fuzzy scalp was itchy, but too tender to scratch.
You're in the green room, sir,
the nurse answered.
Where is the green room?
He would play their deadening game.
The green room is right here, sir, in the Bullfinch building.
And where's the Bullfinch building?
He closed his eyes.
Oh, I see, said the nurse. You're not a regular guest, are you? Well, then, the Bullfinch building is our oldest building here at Applegate. Compared to our newer buildings, it is lacking in some of the more modern facilities, but it more than makes up for that in charm and grace. In fact, many of our guests ask for accommodations here each time they come. This old building has a personality all its...
How long have I been here?
He looked over at her.
Let me see. You're Mr...
She fumbled through the clipboarded papers hanging by the door.
Of course. Mr. Fermoyle, up from detox.
She flipped a page and looked up with a bright smile.
You've been here 4.5 days.
When do I get out?
Her smile was as crisp as her pleated cap.
Dr. Litchfield will be here shortly for orientation, and he'll explain all the little details to you, sir.
She pushed a cart to the bed and cranked it up over his lap. He stared down at the poached egg quivering on a wet slice of puckered toast.
In the meantime, she said, as she opened a delicately barred window, eat up and enjoy the country air.
The fresh air felt like barbed thread passing through his nostrils. He closed his eyes until the nurse was gone. Then he poked at the egg for a moment before devouring it. Cold yolk dribbled down his chin. He was picking crumbs from the plate when a diminutive, slope-shouldered man with a fixed, wan smile entered the room. He introduced himself as Dr. Arnold Litchfield, then stood by the door, flipping through the papers on the clipboard.
Your sister called again this morning,
the doctor said without looking up. He scribbled on one of the papers before coming to the foot of the bed.
Aren't you interested in your sister's call?
He asked watchfully.
Not particularly,
Sam said.
Your sister seems to care a great deal about you, Samuel.
Got a cigarette on you, Doc? I could use a smoke.
Litchfield came to the head of the bed and pushed the red button protruding from the maple headboard. He spoke quickly to the nurse when she came to the door. She was back in a moment with a pack of cools, gold-tipped matches, and a silver-plated ashtray. Sam chuckled as she arranged them on his tray.
Hey, now this is classy,
he laughed. Litchfield watched him tear open the pack. He inhaled deeply and sank back against the pillows.
So, tell me, Doc, how come I'm here and not at the State House where I usually dry out?
The State House? Asked Litchfield.
The State Hospital, Waterbury. Or were they booked for the weekend?
Litchfield gestured to his bandaged head.
Nasty fall you took.
Nasty fall?
Your sister said you passed out and hit your head on her bureau.
Litchfield peered at him.
Do you remember any of that?
I remember. My sister tried to kill me, Doc. I was trying to wake her up, but she wasn't really asleep, because all of a sudden her hand came up from under the sheet with her statue of the Blessed Virgin in it, and the next thing I knew I was on the floor, bleeding like a stuck pig and moaning, "Helen, I'm dying." And she answered back, "I hope so." And she just laid there, and I begged her. I said, "Helen, help me. Don't let me die. If I die," I said, "they'll put you in jail." And she laughed, and she said, "Nope, they'll give me a medal."
He looked up at Litchfield.
"Nice, huh?"
Litchfield perched atop a stool he had pulled close to the bed. He looked down at Sam.
"Do you love your sister?"
He blew a chain of smoke rings into the air.
"This place expensive?"
Litchfield squirmed and folded his arms.
"Since we offer the most enlightened and comfortable care in this part of the country, I would have to say yes."
"I don't get it," he said, scratching his whiskery cheek. "She could have had me committed to the State House for zip."
Looking up at Litchfield, he laughed so hard that the stitches in his scalp throbbed.
"You better run a Dun and Bradstreet on me fast before I even get an aspirin out of this place."
Litchfield smiled and patted his arm.
"The financial arrangements are all in order, Samuel. Your sister is your guardian, and she told me herself that money is not to be a factor in your treatment."
He leaned forward.
"She cares about you, Samuel. She wants you better. It's that simple."
"Simple as shit,"
he groaned, stubbing out one cigarette and lighting another.
"Why do you say that, Samuel?"
Litchfield asked softly. Looking up, he caught a familiar flicker in the doctor's eyes.
"Are we drifting into analysis now, Doc?"
he whispered.
"Only if you'd like to,"
Litchfield whispered back. His head sank back into the pillow, and he closed his eyes.
"Christ, I've been this route 1,000 times. Old docs who fart and fall asleep just when you're telling them how you always wanted to rape your mother. And young docs who refuse to believe you never wanted to rape your mother. Sorry, Doc, but I'm just your average American drunk, and all I want to talk about is when the hell I'm getting out of here."
"When you're reasonably rehabilitated,"
said Litchfield as he slid off the stool. He stood by the door.
"And what the hell does that tell me?"
"As much as you wanted to tell you,"
the doctor said softly.
"You got me here for 30 days, Doc. That's all, damn it. I know my rights. 30 days!
He shouted feebly at the closing door. No one really knew what Omar Duval did during the day once he left the Mayo sisters' boarding house, but every night at supper time his airy whistle drifted down the Fermoyles' driveway. His appetite was incredible. At dinner's end, he would bow his head, declaring himself a burden, a beggar, all the while casting covetous eyes on the few French fries left or the last 3 peas. Inevitably, with dessert, would come his promises. After one night's supper, he had greased the back door hinges with lard. After another, he had tightened the wobbly table legs, and after another, had glued the chair legs. And then one night, as he rolled his eyes in sated gratitude, he saw the ceiling stains from the leaky roof, and to Marie's horror, Marie, who would ask nothing so that nothing could be asked in return, he went next door to borrow a ladder from the clue box. He climbed onto the roof and counted the missing shingles he would replace. He might even have to reflash the chimney. He would spackle the holes in the living room walls. He would pull out the stump on the front lawn and fill in those dusty trenches clue box dog had dug. And while he was at it, he said, pouring the dregs of Benji's milk over his fruit cocktail, he might as well plant some grass seed. He would replace the pane of glass Sam Fermoyle had kicked through the cellar window, as well as the one in the back door. He would mortar the cracks in the foundation and plug each mouse tunnel so tightly that not even the smallest ant could invade this home. Now that he knew the reason for the drawn curtains over the sink, he suggested arborvitae tall enough to block prying eyes. Whatever needed doing, he would do it. "Now take that floor," he said, licking his spoon, then pointing with it. "Why, In a day, he could scrape up that split linoleum, then lay down tiles as shiny as glass. Just say the word, put the right tools in his hand, and he could work wonders. He seemed so vital, so powerful a force, that just the possibility of its unharnessing thrilled and dizzied her. As he spoke, her eyes widened, and the years of neglect vanished with the sweep of his promises. Here was a man who would not only set things straight, but who had already made his way straight through to the core of her loneliness. Now the gouged hairy plaster and the coppery-ringed stains over the stove seemed such minor matters that she no longer noticed them. Now, when she pulled into the driveway, bone-tired from work, she did not see the stump, black as a rotten tooth, and when she came through the back door that swung on velvet hinges, her eyes lifted past the scarred floor in search of Omar. He was a man of not only great strength, but goodness. He reminded her of her father, broad-backed, simple, kind, and very proud. When she had offered to help Omar with his first week's rent, his eyes had welled with tears, and he had turned away, unable to speak. She had wanted to throw her arms around him and hold him close. What had stopped her then, and still did now, each time she desired his touch, had been her children's presence in the next room. For Norm, his mother's happiness these last few weeks seemed a shimmering, fragile bubble. Even the shattering pitch of her laughter sent a shiver up his spine, its sudden rawness so much like crying that he would tense, ready to spring, his hands clutching the arms of the chair. He had never seen her like this before, gullible and giggly, at times even shy and blushing. He sensed in Duval a strange element, some dark and discernible emanation that both fouled and thinned the air, shrinking the tiny rooms in this box of a house smaller still. Every night after supper, Duval and his mother stayed at the kitchen table, where they would talk for hours. Actually, Duval did most of the talking, while Norm lay in bed, listening. Duval spoke as ravenously as he ate, mountains of words. When Norm finally fell asleep, it was with the drugged consciousness of Duval's voice in the distance. After midnight, he awakened, gasping as if the breath were being sucked from his lungs. Duval was still down there, still talking as the room swayed, the dark heat undulating with his drawl until Norm felt sick to his stomach. He got up and knelt by the window, anchoring his chin over the sill, his brow to the screen, as he took deep breaths of the skunk-filled night. "Why doesn't he go home?" he wondered. "What are they talking about? What does he want?" And all at once it occurred to him that Duval was home, more home than he had ever been, and he was waiting for Norm to leave. In this house where flesh never touched except in anger, Omar Duval was a toucher and a grasper. It gave Alice the creeps to see his large hands reach across the table to cover Benji's or his sweaty arm on the back of her mother's chair. Over her own untouched plate, she watched how he ate, the little sweat beads quivering on his temples, his lips trembling with anticipation as the fork rose, the delicate chewing, the soft moan and rolling eyes as he swallowed, and her stomach would turn with his gluttony. From nowhere, the stranger at the door had come to be everywhere. Even when she was in her room with the radio on, his languorous voice, like his sweet cologne, seeped up through the floorboards in a sly caress. She had also noticed the change in her mother. Even if Duval was the phony Norm claimed, at least their mother's tearful rages and black moods had subsided. The days of numbing despair had been reduced to quick flashes of temper that Duval always managed to calm. He had given nothing and somehow worked a miracle. And for this, no one was more grateful than Benji, and no one was more mystified, because there were times when Duval seemed as much that hunted face in the raw sunlight, a quivering white slug that clung to the corner of the house, a sweet-talking, cold-eyed voice whispering into the telephone when he thought no one was near, as he was a brave man who was afraid of black men, someone with perhaps as many faces and secrets as the boy himself. Tonight, Marie was exhausted. All these late nights with Omar were as exhilarating as they were tiring. This morning, Mr. Briscoe had marched back a letter that had three typos in one line, and then after lunch he'd caught her dozing with her head in her arms. With a glance at the clock over the sink, she got up from the table and poured more lemonade into Omar's glass. As she started to turn back to the refrigerator, he caught her hand and smiled broadly. "Such a wonderful woman," he said, gazing up at her. Her face flamed, and she drew her cheek shyly across her shoulder and eased away.
"You are,"
he said as she stood at the open refrigerator, staring at its bright emptiness. Just yesterday, she had brought home another $15 worth of food.
"And I want to show my gratitude, if you'll allow me."
His voice trailed off. She was conscious of the crickets near the window as well as the refrigerator's motor chugging in the same rhythmic pattern as Omar's breath.
"Come here,"
he said softly. She turned slowly, arms rigid at her sides, her chest sore with unexpellable breath. He took her hands and said,
"I am about to make an offer which you will probably turn down, and if you do, I will understand."
He smiled painfully.
"After all, why should you accept? You barely know me. In fact, you know nothing about me except what I've told you. For all you know, before you here sits Jack the Ripper."
He laughed a little.
"But you are a woman of faith, Marie, a believer, one of that rare breed who moves by instinct."
She felt her knees weaken, her head weightless and spinning. Her eyes roved blindly. How could she accept the proposal of a man she had known for only a few weeks? He would have to be patient. He would have to understand how it wasn't just her, but her children. First, they would have to get to know him better. Benji would be easy. She had seen how his eyes trailed Omar, as if he dared not lose sight of him. Norm's bitterness might take a long time to overcome, but Alice...
"A partner," Omar was saying. "A risk-taker."
He swallowed hard.
"A woman like yourself,"
he said, raising his eyes hopefully to hers.
"It's the kids," she started to say. "They..."
He held up his hand.
"Hear me out. Allow me that."
He fiddled with his tie points, then cleared his throat.
"The only way to look at this is in dollars and cents, Marie. Don't be swayed by my affections or by any pity you may feel for me. Look at this for what it is. An investment, a chance, an opportunity to knock on fortune's golden door."
She regarded him curiously. For a moment she wanted to laugh. Such a strange proposal from such a strange man. His eyelids were heavy and wet. Sweat glistened on his chin. He's almost fat, she thought. He is fat. He eats too much. He eats as if he might never eat again. A breeze brushed past her legs. Next door, Jesse and Harvey Klubach had been having a cookout. Now their friends laughed, hooting loudly at whatever game was being played. The smell of meat that had been sizzling on the charcoal still came through the back door. Harvey was a butcher at the Meatorama and always got the best cuts. Oftentimes, Marie had seen him open the toolbox in his trunk and lift out paper-wrapped steaks and roasts she just knew he had stolen. And Jessie, with her fine blonde curls and her eager smile, Jessie was everyone's sweetheart. Oh, but Marie knew, wished, had seen, or imagined Jessie playing up to the mailman and the meter reader in her skimpy shorts, swinging her tight little hips up and down the front steps all day when the telephone linemen were putting up a new pole. Yes, she thought, Jessie and Harvey were headed for trouble. She looked back at the window, suddenly alarmed, because she needed them there, with their windows shining, their lawn mowed, their hedges pruned, their lives intact now as her own found form. Omar unfolded a piece of paper, which he smoothed open on the table.
"Listen," he said, reading. "Tired of the 8 hours a day, the 40 hours a week, the month after month, the year after year after year? Tired of the grind, tired of the rat race, tired of taking orders, tired of never getting anywhere?"
He glanced up.
"Tired of knowing that no matter how hard you work, nothing will ever get better?"
The flesh on her face seemed to shrink on her skull. From next door, a woman cried a little drunkenly,
"You're such a peach, Jessie!"
Omar continued to read.
"Then this ad is meant for you. Presto Soap is a nationwide company looking for a few bright people anxious to change their lives around through hard work and diligent investment. Get in on the ground floor. Call 771-4812 and ask for Bob."
He stared at her.
"I called," he said.
He grabbed her hand and squeezed it while he told her how the state franchisor, Bob, was sick, so they had given him another number to call, the national distributor, the number one man. Omar fumbled through his pockets, laying lint and pennies and candy wrappers on the table until he came to a scrap of yellow paper torn from a telephone book, scribbled with a name.
Roy Gold, he read. The Roy Gold of Gold Mine Enterprises. He said he liked the timbre of my voice. He said he could feel the vibrations of my enthusiasm over the telephone wires. Marie, he said they had thousands of calls, but he could tell I was the one. He banged his fist on the table and grinned. I've got a shot at being a franchiser for the whole state, he sighed. But my problem is collateral.
He looked at her.
I need help, Marie, a partner. I need a shrewd investor at my side, a woman like yourself.
From the clue box, a surge of laughter broke over the night. Marie laughed, too, but her eyes blurred with tears.
I'll tell you a secret, she said in a low voice. Last year, Benji brought home a kitten he'd found, and I let him keep it for 2 days. And then I took it to work with me one morning. I let it out behind the fish market. I couldn't even afford to buy cat food. That's how bad things are.
She took Omar's glass and rinsed it out. Klubok's party was ending. Car doors opened and closed.
Come again, Jesse cried. We had so much fun.
Thanks for coming, Harvey called. See you guys at camp next week.
We'll keep an eye on her, Harv,
a man called.
I don't know, Harv, a woman called. You know what they say, when the cat's away.
Omar stood up, pushed in the chair, then lifted the ad from the table and looked at it a moment.
There's the trust money. You could take them to court for all.
I can't do that. I can't fight them. I can't go through that. I just can't.
I understand, he said softly.
Omar did not come the following night or the night after that. Tonight, as Marie absently stirred her creamed corn over her plate, Alice asked what was wrong. She stared at her daughter.
Do you really want to know?
Alice's face looked gray. Norman Benji grimaced.
Well, I'll tell you, she said, arranging her fork and knife and spoon next to her plate with exaggerated care. I'm tired. I'm tired of working 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, year after year. I'm tired of the rat race. I'm tired of never getting ahead. I'm tired.
They looked at her, their eyes shifting imperceptibly as they aligned their vision in the low yellow quiet that filled the room. They were done eating, but didn't dare leave the table. The phone began to ring, and Marie jumped for it.
Hello?
She said too anxiously.
Oh, she's right here, Les.
Alice took the phone, then turned her back to them.
We're eating just now. Why don't I call you back?
You won't, though,
Lester was shouting so loud they all heard him.
You never call me back.
I will, in a few minutes, Alice said.
No, you won't. I know you won't.
Alice pressed the button down, then left the phone off the hook.
No, Marie said, pointing. Hang it up. Don't leave it like that.
Omar might be trying to call her at this very moment.
But he'll just call back, and I don't want to talk to him, Alice said. Well, think about the rest of us. Maybe someone's trying to call one of us right now.
No one's trying to call me. I don't care,
Norm said.
Me neither, Benji said. I don't care.
Well, I do,
she cried, slamming the receiver onto the cradle.
I care, goddammit. I care very much.
She turned back and caught them looking at one another. The phone rang and she picked it up, forcing herself to speak calmly.
Hello?
Don't hang up, please.
Lester gasped in her ear.
I can't stand this. You've got to forgive me. I'm so miserable. I miss you so much. I ache all.
Alice can't come to the phone right now, Lester. She's busy. She's going to be very busy tonight.
Good, Alice said when she hung up. He's driving me crazy.
He's such a creep,
Norm said.
Yeah, Benji agreed. He's lonely, she said. It's a terrible feeling to be alone. Don't look at me like that, the three of you. You have each other, so you don't know what that's like. You don't know how frightening that can be, how lost and desperate you can get.
They stared down at the table.
Believe me, you have no idea, she said.
Even at dusk, the air was still heavy with a relentless heat. Quick black slashes of fleeing birds darted across the orange sky. Benji was in the yard, unpinning dry clothes from the line, when Louie crossed the driveway.
"Can I go in the box?"
Louie asked. "If you want," Benji said, pleased to see Louie again after so many weeks. "Where you been?" he asked, twice folding a stiff towel before dropping it into the basket.
"No place."
"What's up?"
"Nothing. My father's fishing at camp."
Louie sat cross-legged in the box opening. "Oh, yeah," he said, the twinge of dread recalling Mr. Briscoe's pledge to take him fishing this summer. He no longer carried on the ruse of going up to the swimming pool every day. Now he just lied and said he did.
"Louis,"
Mrs. Klubach called from her back steps.
"Benji, have you seen Louie?"
"He's over here, in the box," he called back.
"Louis, get over here,"
Mrs. Klubach demanded with a stamp of her foot when Louie dragged into sight.
"She's scared," Louie said quickly to Benji. "Some man keeps calling and he won't stop."
He looked frightened.
"What did I tell you?"
Mrs. Klubach scolded as Louie climbed the stairs.
"You stay in your own yard where I can see you."
She hustled him inside and locked both doors. Behind Benji came a quick rustling through the weeds and wild hedges. Then the shiny, blunt head of Klubach's dog broke into sight.
"Hey, hey, boy,"
he whispered. He knelt down and held out his hand, but the dog pulled back, its eyes bright with a wary wildness. Clenched in its mouth was a long strip of brown cloth, cuffed at one end like a pant leg.
"Come here, come here," he coaxed.
But the dog sprang then, flying past him, diving into the lilac thicket, and as it went, his stomach turned with the stench. It was the most disgusting thing he had ever smelled. Chief Stoner's love affair had started a year ago January. It had been his wife's canasta night, and Eunice Bonifant's car had run out of gas, even though she owned the busiest gas station in town. Typical, Sonny had been thinking, as he buckled his boots and listened to his sister-in-law's throaty laughter coming from the pantry. Ever since her husband Al's suicide, Eunice seemed to be either in the depths of depression or laughing hysterically. She was a careless woman, and carelessness made Sonny nervous. His virtue was as much rooted in superstition as in goodness. There were dark forces in the universe, forces ready to pounce on careless men, forces that demanded appeasement. His talismans against such furies were the insurance policies in his strongbox, the bomb shelter in his backyard, the lightning rods on his roof. To this end, he had taught his deputies that keeping their guns cleaned and oiled meant never having to use them. When Eunice got into his car that January night, she asked him the time. 10:45, he told her as he pulled onto the dark street, heartened by the clank of the tires' chains over the ice. She asked if he'd mind speeding it up a little so she wouldn't be late. "Late for what?" he asked irritably. "My obscene phone call," she sighed.
"Your what?"
"My obscene phone caller. He calls every night."
"Eunice," he said, never knowing whether to believe her or not.
"It's a riot, Sonny. He breathes and I breathe back."
She lit a cigarette and blew out a smoky laugh.
"The creep can't believe his good luck."
He glanced at her. After Al's funeral, she had invited everyone back to the house, then got so drunk she passed out. He remembered how disgusted he had been to see Carol, red-eyed from weeping, trying to coax Eunice up to bed. Carol had been devastated enough by her brother's suicide and didn't need any of Eunice's trashy scenes. "Leave her on the couch," he'd told Carol, but she'd refused, saying Eunice wouldn't have left her.
"I think I know who it is," Eunice said.
"Who?"
he asked, frowning over the wheel. She touched his arm.
"Promise you won't tell Carol?" she whispered solemnly.
"Last night I heard church bells in the background. I think it's the Monsignor,"
she said, bursting into laughter.
"I think he's got the hots for me."
Just then, a call had come over the radio reporting a disturbance up at the pig farm. He'd check it out as soon as he made one more stop, he said, looking at Eunice.
"No siree," she roared. "The Monsignor'll just have to wait."
As they drove along the dark, winding road to the pig farm, Eunice lit another cigarette and stared out the window.
"God, I haven't been out here in years," she said with a shiver. "Al and I used to park somewhere along here."
As they came over the rise, she pointed to the frozen gully below.
"Right there's where we parked," she laughed. "Al used to break branches off and put them over the windows."
She was quiet again.
"Al always covered his bases," Sonny said pointedly.
Al had been a judicious man. His only lapse in judgment had been Eunice, though Carol used to say she was the best thing that had ever happened to her morose brother.
"Yep,"
Eunice sighed.
"Our own private fuck blind, he called it."
He couldn't help it. He burst out laughing. Eunice just stared out the window. When they came to the farm, Grandine Carson ran out of the old gray house in his bathrobe and boots to report that someone had been banging on his windows. Sonny walked around the house, beaming his flashlight on the untracked, crusted snow, knowing he would find nothing. The pigman had spent too many years alone. He was so accustomed to his trespassers that when they didn't come, he invented them.
"See anything?" Eunice asked when he came back.
"Nothing,"
Sonny sighed, ducking his long body into the cruiser.
"Every now and again, he just needs to know someone's around, I guess."
"I know the feeling," Eunice sighed, watching the ice-blasted trees flick past as they started back down the road. He glanced at her. He was more accustomed to her blowsy humor than this melancholy.
"Hey,"
he chided after a minute,
"I'm not used to you being so quiet. Cut it out."
"I was just thinking. Poor Carson, all he needs is a woman. You know, it's tough being alone. It really is. Being alone can make you crazy."
"Uh-uh, no excuse."
He shook his head.
"You were always crazy, Eunice."
She laughed.
"And you were always a pain in the ass, just like Al, the two of you."
At that, he stopped the car, threw it into reverse, and switched on the flashing lights.
"What the hell are you doing?"
she gasped as they headed backward down the road.
"I'm bringing the pig man a woman,"
he laughed over his shoulder.
"Sure will cut down on these late-night runs."
The car filled with her rocky laughter as she grabbed his arm and jammed her foot down on the brake, spiraling the cruiser over the ice. And as it turned and turned and turned, he felt it all getting away from him, all that caution, all that good sense. And he wasn't afraid or angry, but laughing just as much as she was, even as the car slid over the soft shoulder, coming to rest against a snowdrift as gently and silently as a head sinks into a pillow. He closed his eyes and kissed Eunice Bonifant's warm, wet mouth while the dome light spun red whorls on the snow. 1 month later, Dr. Hess had called him at the station and asked him to stop by the office. Before he had even hung up the phone, Sonny knew that the price he'd pay for his sin would be Carol. Lately, he understood nothing. Carol was dying, and he cried out in his sleep and sat up trembling with cold sweats in the heat. He couldn't bear to look at his ravaged wife. His son got on his nerves all the time. His men thought him demanding and unreasonable with them, and far too easy on the town's transgressors. Their chief never target practiced with them anymore. At the station, he sat in his closed office and stared out the window over Merchant's Row, bewildered to find the bright July world so grimed with gray. His men thought it was his wife he mourned, but it was himself. Tonight, the council room was stiff with heat and surly voices. Sonny Stoner squirmed in the hard oak chair. He had never liked meetings, and this one was always the most grueling. It was the annual vote on Joey Selden's popcorn stand, postponed these last few weeks because of Judge Clay's death.
"Nothing but an eyesore," John Kreller was saying, "and one of these days the whole shebang's going to come down on some innocent passerby, and then there'll be hell to pay. The town'll be up to their ears in lawsuits."
Sonny scraped his fingernail along the soft grime on the lip of the oak table. The popcorn stand that Sonny had helped build years ago as a boy was now falling apart. All that was left of the original roof was tar paper strips that lifted in the slightest breeze. Some of the sideboards had buckled from the studs, and the rotten corner posts had become as precarious as the old man's disposition. For years, Joey had refused to repair the stand, claiming its upkeep was the town's responsibility. Recently, when people had tried to help by repairing the stand themselves, Joey had alienated them with his demands and criticism. And now, neighbors around the park were complaining about his radio, which blared past midnight some nights.
"If he'd just say thanks," Kreller was saying, "but every year it's the same thing. Gimme, gimme, gimme."
Sonny tilted his wrist to look at his watch. He should have been at Eunice's an hour ago. When he'd left the house tonight, Lester had called him a hypocrite when he said he had to work late. Lester wanted to see Alice tonight. He'd never seen his son so angry, so violent. Lester had raised his fists, and Sonny had all he could do to keep from smacking him.
I say we do the old man a favor and bulldoze the thing, Preller said with a nod. He sat down, and next to him, Jarden Green grinned. Sonny's foot began to tap. He could feel Craig Bixby, the town council, and a friend of both Joey Selden and old Judge Clay, staring at him. Bixby expected Sonny to stand up now and deliver the judge's yearly speech on Joey's behalf. Joey Selden had been Atkinson's chief of police before Sonny's father. Selden's brief career as chief had ended one night years ago up on Humpback Mountain with a violent explosion at Towler's still that killed Ark Towler and left Joey Selden comatose for weeks and then blind. Because Selden hadn't served long enough to qualify for a pension, the town built the popcorn stand and turned it over to him in a festive hero's ceremony. Everyone was there, even Towler's widow and her three little girls. Through all the speeches and songs, she stood under a tree, her blank expression never changing. When the ribbon was cut and Joey was finally led inside the red enameled stand to applause and cheers, she smiled, then walked away. Joey had been off duty the night of the explosion, and the rumors had already started that he had been at Towler's that night, picking up his fee for silence. Now Craig Bixby was trying to catch his eye, but Sonny just sat there. Let Bixby stick his neck out for once, he thought, as he stared wearily at his folded hands. Other men were looking down the table at him. They knew it was his turn. Why did they do this every year, he suddenly wondered. Why not vote Joey a 10- or 20-year lease on the stand? Why had no one ever thought of this before? The mayor rose now and patted his jacket pockets. He leafed through his papers, then, with a glance at Sonny, raised his eyebrows expectantly. Sonny would not look up. His toes curled in his shoes.
"Well, here we go again," the mayor began good-naturedly. "Beating the same old dead horse."
His eyes glazed with a memory of Eunice's husky voice describing the smooth satin sheet she'd put on the bed tonight.
"And Sonny'll go up there tonight and tell Joey he can stay. But the condition is he's got to close at 9 sharp. No ifs, ands, or buts."
"You told him that last year," Preller called out.
Jarden Green nodded furiously.
"And his excuse last year was he had to keep the radio loud so's he could hear the time when to close."
Green nudged him then, and Preller added,
"And even with the radio loud, he still stayed open till all hours."
Green nodded smugly. Green and Joey had been going at it for years. Each wanted to be the park maestro.
"Okay,"
the mayor said, rubbing his chin.
10 of 9 curfew, then. Sonny, you tell Joey when he hears the 10 of 9 blow, he'd better blow, too."
The council members chuckled. Some had begun to pack up their papers. Craig Bixby was unwrapping the big green vial-smelling cigar that always signaled the end of a meeting. The mayor looked up to take the vote.
"Betcha he don't do it,"
Preller called out suddenly, with Green hunched at his elbow.
"And instead of a vote on the popcorn stand, by Jesus, I propose we vote on an investigating committee to find out what Selden was really doing up at the still that night."
The men groaned. Bixby laid the cigar on the table as the mayor looked entreatingly at Sonny. Preller was one of those for whom every issue had to be a life-or-death struggle. Last meeting, at Robert Haddad's urging, he had made a motion to ban women in shorts from all public places. Every year it was the same complaints about Joey's arrogance, his lack of gratitude, the same speeches, the same defenders, but then, at the last moment, the same resounding vote to grant the old man his space on the corner of the park for one more year. Now the mayor had taken up Joey's defense again. Sonny felt the room seethe with heat and the bitter smoke of newly lit cigarettes. The men coughed and squirmed in their seats. It was going badly. Jarden Green was on his feet, arguing with the mayor.
"No, sir," Green ranted. "This is a matter for the courts. I move we let Bixby here earn the lawyer money we vote him every year and let the courts settle this popcorn shit once and for all."
Attorney Bixby swung his black briefcase onto the table, and as he stood up, he cast a hopeful look at Sonny. Bixby tugged at his tie knot and sighed.
"Fine with me, Jard."
He smiled down at Green's pinched face.
"Maybe I'm not too bright, but I really don't see the harm in you sending one of your crews over with a jar of paint and a few shingles and a couple of nails to give that damn stand a quick one-two."
Bixby peered over the top of his wire-rimmed glasses.
"It'd be a hell of a lot cheaper than a court fight."
"Couple of nails and a jar of paint,"
Green scoffed, looking up and down the table.
Next thing Craig'll be up here asking why I don't run a crew down to the tracks and spruce up Nigger Flood's place.
The council chuckled. Green's remark had been a dig at Mrs. Bigsby's annual chairmanship of the Fresh Air Fund, which delivered a dusty busload of New York street kids to Atkinson's Green Valley every August. Bigsby's face reddened, and his shrewd old eyes narrowed, and now, as he spoke, Sonny recognized the old courtroom cadence.
"That's right, Jard. There's a lot wrong in this world. A lot of people born a second too late and a step behind, or maybe even just a little different from you and me. And there's not a lot we can do about it. We meet here every week to talk about wild dogs in Compsons and variances and which department's going to get a new water bubbler. And, of course, Mr. Kreller's indignation over public indecency. But every once in a great while, we get to vote on one of those big issues. Not from any laws or statute, Jard, but from in here," he said, thumping his chest. "We got important business here, Jard, and you're asking us to tear down a poor, harmless, blind man's popcorn stand, his only means of support." He paused. "Why, Jard? Wouldn't have anything to do with that little incident with his radio during your last song, would it?"
"Of course not," Green spat.
"Wouldn't have anything to do with his popcorn maybe being a bigger draw than your music, would it?"
"You're demeaning me!"
Green hollered over the hoots of laughter. Bigsby stopped pacing and jabbed his finger at Green.
"You're demeaning yourself, damn it. Now why don't you just forget this nonsense and get a crew up there and fix up Selden's stand and be done with it?"
The council broke into scattered applause.
"No, sir!"
Green screamed, pounding his tiny fist on the table.
"There's a principle here, the same principle that keeps me from hot-topping council members' driveways on town time and seeding their lawn like's been done by every head of public works before me."
Green was on his feet now, his spare body trembling with rage.
"You can sure as hell fire me, but you can't buy me, and goddammit, you won't humiliate me."
With that, he stalked out of the room. The men blinked as the door slammed, then a few cleared their throats guiltily and dared take a breath. Not a one had had their driveways resurfaced free by town crews since Green had been appointed. Bigsby was still staring at the door.
"Whew," he said, turning back to the table. "Almost didn't get his cross through," he muttered.
There was laughter, but it came thinly, uneasily. Robert Haddad seemed screwed into a corner of his chair. For one so often indignant lately over everything, tonight he had said nothing. He was biting his nails. He glanced at his watch and sighed. Looking up and down the table, Sonny felt not only detached but distant from these men, most of whom he had known all his life. And it came to him now, the reason for the Towler widow's cold smile. It had been a smile of triumph as the blind man entered his stand that day, faltering, then lurching like an animal locked in its cage for the first time. Kreller's words were sobering the council. A few nodded anxiously.
"Hoodlums tearing up and down the streets on their motorcycles, and their souped-up cars blasting their nigger music, while the young girls walk the streets with next to nothing on. Nothing sacred anymore, nothing, because certain persons in this town in positions of authority, certain officials, are so busy hiding their own sins and transgressions they got no time to do their job."
Sonny stared at his folded hands. He felt drained. It was getting late. Time. What time was it? And what the hell was Kreller talking about? He looked up to see eyes quickly averted. Kreller had meant him.
"Now I'm only telling you what was reported to me. I'm only saying that something's very wrong with a dead man sitting in his chair for 2 days and nobody says a word. I'm telling you, it's all going to pieces. They tear up our public property. There's a stink hanging over this town so bad people can't sleep nights. The way I was raised, you got a problem, you root it out."
Kreller shook his head bitterly.
"But of course, the way I was raised don't count no more. Used to be, every kid was in his house before the 10 of even blew. But now everything's changed. Nobody listens to good men anymore. Now you break and enter, and what do you get? A slap on the wrist, that's all. A ride to the enlistment office in the chief's car, if you please. I tell you, our kids are running wild.
You go up to that park right now, and you'll find their kind of hero with his radio blasting and kids hanging all over the bandstand, smashing bottles and calling filth out to our women passing by.
You're kidding,
Sonny muttered, but no one heard him. He wondered if this could be true, if in the malaise of the past weeks such events had indeed transpired while he had been too preoccupied to notice.
He's the seed, the cause, Kreller ranted. You can tell him to go home till you're blue in the face, but he don't give a damn for anyone or anything, and those kids know it. And they won't go home, neither. So go ahead. Keep on looking the other way. Keep on honoring liars and thieves.
Sonny Stoner jumped up so fast that the table lifted against his legs.
Honor? You call that honor? Harnessing a proud man like Joey Selden to that ragtag of a stand? Putting him at the mercy of men like you, Kreller? That ain't honor. No, sir, I call that the worst punishment of all. I call that degrading.
A pulsing had begun in the tall man's head, like red-hot pumping blood that both frightened and cleansed him. They looked up stupidly and a little hurt, and yet he kept on, his gentle voice growing so loud that he was sure someone else was talking.
I was just thinking, listening to all this talk, how this is the one meeting out of the whole year everybody shows up for, and you know why? Because it's a chance to play God for a night. We're not here to vote from our hearts. We're here to pass judgment on Joey Selden one more time. So forget it, John. Of course we're never going to vote down his stand, because if we do that, then we can't go home feeling good about ourselves.